Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. This is Fanny Crawford.
And this is Stash Ziokelski.
And today is Monday, November 9th, 2020. Yes. We have made it this far. And our theme today is celebrating Veterans Day.
Yay!
We have some interesting stories scheduled for you this morning.
I hope so. It was the 11th day, the 11th hour, 11th day.
Well, it's actually 12 o'clock for our listeners.
Yeah, well, anyway, okay. I was just quoting, quoting from, you know, all the remembrances of how this day came about.
Ah, well, that's something we could talk about later.
Yeah.
Okay. And I bet you have a lot of announcements, storytelling announcements.
Well, I have announcements. Tomorrow night, Donna Washington will be performing at Speak. You know, and you can find out details by going to speakstoryseries.com. And it will tell you how to register and how to pay. And also, at some time during tomorrow night's concert, Adam Booth will be announcing the performer for December 8th. It's unusual, very early in the month, earlier than most, but that's just because
of the way the numbers fall.
The way the numbers fall, right. So December 8th, we will have a guest, and Adam has not announced it publicly yet because he was waiting for the contract. And I'm pretty excited because it's going to be a balladeer. I won't say the name, but I know it's going to be a balladeer who tells stories. And I like that. Well, today we have a budget meeting. you know, one of my
favorite
things.
Are you excited?
Things.
Yes,
I was. It's one of my favorite things is to be a member of a committee and stuff. You know, I'm volunteering for. I sent a short note to our president elect that I am available for Secretary of Education, and I would be glad to fix the education system in the country. So
we all have something to look forward to.
Yes, my trial would be interesting. Some of my former students would love to see that.
Okay, but you had some other things, other events you were talking about. You should talk about Telebration.
The Telebration is coming up in 2 weeks.
On this very radio show.
Absolutely. And we're going to be talking about Thanksgiving. And we're going to spread that a little bit. At least people have the option of either telling about the Thanksgiving dinners they've been to, or just Thanksgiving in general, or the dinners they haven't been to, and things
past,
like
present,
that.
And future.
Yeah, that's great. That's why you're the boss. Because you have the command. You have the command of that right out of the air. You got that and remembered it. Whereas I would have had to look at my notes.
Mark and Julia Brew will be here.
Right.
Sharing the stage with us.
Yes. And let's see. Okay. Tomorrow night, I'll be involved in three different storytelling programs. Three consecutive hours, which will be exciting because I'll get to be working with the young people and best friends in up in the Pittsburgh area. Actually, it'll be Zoom, so it won't be in any area because they're spread out. And then the guild that I started in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, will be meeting at 6:30 tomorrow. And I've been attending meetings. And that's nice because the people who are keeping it going are good friends of mine. And then 7:30, Donna Washington. It's going to be exciting. Also, I believe there's a chance that Adam Booth will be at least giving a strong hint about the 12 performers for next year for Speak. Dan Thomas and I, Dan Thomas is another board member, and we were on duty on Sunday at the market, the farmer's market in Shepherdstown, giving out information. And the person who is in charge of that and has been, Carolyn, was self-quarantining because she was exposed to someone who had tested positive. And so she trusted the two bearded guys. And I thought we made a nice presentation to people as they were passing. We talked to a lot of friendly people in front of the library in Shepherdstown. Met a lot of dogs.
Yeah. Have you considered competing in the beard department with Dan Thomas?
In the beard? No. Oh, no, no. No, he's a ZZ Top kind of guy.
Yeah, quite impressive.
No, it is impressive, but it's a lot of trouble. You have to take, it's a lot of trouble to have a long beard. I've never had a beard that long. So, are you talking?
I did say something, but it was probably better muted.
Okay.
I won't repeat it. Okay.
Yeah. No.
All right.
No. You mentioned the beard. Let me tell you a funny little anecdote. Okay.
Okay.
When I was in college, and I grew my first beard, sophomore year in college, 1963. My very favorite aunt. My Aunt Madsie, when I came home for a break, she saw me at a family. We were at the family having something. And she said, "You used to be such a nice boy." I said, "Wait, what happened?" She said, "That beard, you look like a beatnik." And she really, it's funny, she really didn't like my beard. It was, and I think now there are so many beards nowadays. If you see, if you go to any kind of group gathering and there is no one with a beard, you would think you'd gone into the wrong place. So anyway, that's my, what do you call it? The hair of the dog story, but it's really not. The hair of the old man story.
I would like to take this opportunity to thank Andy Offutt-Irwin for introducing our show this morning. Original composition, Tarry Here. Thank you, Andy.
And he does not wear a beard.
No, I've never seen Andy with a beard.
No, I don't think it would look appropriate, especially when Aunt Marguerite is talking.
That's true. Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that. Although there are some bearded ladies.
Oh my goodness.
Probably not Aunt Marguerite.
We had a bearded lady in my neighborhood when I was a kid in Baltimore. Mm. Used to see her down on Broadway sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon at all. Now that the population is almost primarily old women, there are a lot of us.
Anyway, that's a statistic I'm going to challenge.
You can count on me for interesting statistics.
Are we
going to tell any long form stories today?
Well,
aside from 1 minute anecdotes.
Oh well, I have a story about. I have some information about I have some veteran stories that involve me.
That's exciting.
Yeah, well, because I'm a veteran.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
And power to you.
Thank you. Possibly one of the best things I ever did in my life was volunteer to go in the Army. Some people would say it was the worst thing I did in my life, but
no.
Anyway. So.
So, okay, so you have more than one.
Well, you know me.
So you should start.
Possibly. Well, I will start and we'll see, okay?
Yes. And before we do that, give me a time check.
It is 10 minutes.
Okay.
Okay. So until, truly, I have told stories before and had people actually challenge me and say, I couldn't believe that part. It just didn't make sense that you could be that ignorant or that unobservant or that, unaware. And
I believe that part.
Yeah, that I could be that way.
Yeah.
Jeez, thanks. That's a great beginning. Okay, well.
Just trying to give you a vote of confidence there, Scott.
I appreciate it because that works with this. Right after high school, almost immediately, July 31st of 1959, I was sworn in as a member of the United States Army. I volunteered. I was 17 years old. Had to beg my father to sign the papers. And that was because two members of our family had died, one in Korea and one in World War II. And my dad was worried about his little boy. The only way I got him to sign the papers was I reminded him that there was no war, which was an unusual thing. There might have been small things going on in different parts of the world, but the United States was not involved in a war in 1959. So 3 years later, I got out of the Army. And until I started college, I can honestly say I did not pay attention to or know anything about Veterans Day. And as a freshman in college, one of the things I received from organizations was a membership card to the American Legion and another membership card to the Veterans of Foreign War in Emmitsburg, Maryland. And that was a shock to me until I had a talk with one of the priests at school, and he talked about Veterans Day and how that day had been set aside as a special day to honor men, and it was set aside at first to honor the men who had served in the military. It's not the same as Memorial Day, which honors the people who died in service to the country. And it was interesting to be called a veteran at the age of 21. And also, I guess the most interesting part was automatic respect. I was the oldest member of my freshman class in college. I was 3 years older than everybody else. To receive automatic respect without having to earn it was a very interesting thing. There was one senior. We both played soccer. I was on the soccer team. He was a man by the name of Bobby Brown, who had been in the Marines. He when he came and introduced himself after the first day of soccer practice, and we talked about the military, it was like such an eye-opening thing that here this veteran who was married, I believe he had two children, treated me so well, and not for anything that I had ever done except leave home and join the Army. And during my time at college and afterwards, I embraced the respect I received for being a veteran, because as I matured, I began to understand, especially because by the time I graduated from college, our country was embroiled in Vietnam. And there were members of my college, the classes, who were volunteering, or in Bobby Brown's case, he was called back into the military. He was an officer. And one of the most tragic things that for him and his family, tragic really, but also struck me very hard, was he died in Vietnam. And that was a bitter thing, because he was a great, great man. He loved his family, cared about his wife dearly, and was actually, I felt bad about the fact that he had been a starter for the soccer team for 3 years. And then when I came to the school, I took his position. And that's not the best way to say it, because I didn't take anything. It just, I was a better player. And the coach put me in the first team. And Bobby, he never, ever regretted that. You know, he was relegated to the bench and played a little bit of time in each game. But he was always really behind me and cheering for me and encouraged me. And I think that I learned from that situation that when someone respects you, even if they respect you just because you were a member of the same organization, it really makes a big difference in how you perform and in how you respect yourself. So after my freshman year in college, I can honestly say I did embrace the idea that I was a veteran, and that I did do, no matter what my original reasons were for joining the Army at 17, I did do something that people acknowledged was a worthwhile thing to do in order to serve our country. As I progressed through my college career and then graduate school and accepted a teaching job for the next 40 years, every place I went that acknowledgement of being a veteran helped me throughout my career. The school system, I doubt if they do this nowadays, but back in the 60s, at least the school system I started in, when I transferred after my first 3 years of teaching, I transferred from a private school to a public school, and I went to the to an interview, had a nice interview, was offered the job, went to the school, interviewed there, and received the job. The principal who interviewed me was impressed that I was a veteran. When I went to the board office, the man who took care of my paperwork and looked at my papers from the military. I had done some teaching in the military. I had also gone to school in the military. Because of that, and because of being a veteran, I received credit in the public school system for the 3 years I taught in the private school system based on my military service. And that was just wonderful because that means instead of starting out after 3 full years of teaching, starting out at zero towards a retirement, I began at plus three. And that mattered on not only towards retirement, that mattered in my pay. My paycheck was better by three little steps than it would have been if I had been starting at the first step. Once again, because of being a veteran. And I thought for a long time that I was getting things without having earned them. But after a long time, maybe my entire career, and finally being what truly is considered an old man, looking back on it, and having known so many people in the military, and having friends in the military, understanding that being a veteran in many places, especially in this country, in at least a majority of groups, is a respected thing. And grateful people at all levels will, I don't know if the word is endow, but will give you benefits because of your service to your country. And I value that now more than ever, because it does put you in a special group. Now, if our politics would catch up, there would be another day for veterans, and there is in some states. Believe it or not, November 11th is Veterans Day. It was originally called Armistice Day. Of course, you know that, I'm sure. Many people know that. And the 11th of November, at the 11th hour, and at the end of World War I, was when the treaty was signed. And so November 11th was Armistice Day. Now it's Veterans Day. However, there is a separate day, June 12th, for Women's Veterans Day. And I can tell from your face that you are surprised, or at least I think so. Anyway, but it's not a federal holiday, which once more is a reminder of how much work we have to do in our country. Because with everything else, being able to vote and own property and all that stuff through our history, the women veterans of our country don't have a federal holiday. They have state holiday. Many states do celebrate June 12th. And that was just started in the 2000s. So there have been two bills pushed in Congress in the last couple of years. And one of them that is currently there is proposed by Senator Cory Booker. And hopefully the next Congress will get that passed so that Women's Veterans Day will become a federal holiday, because they certainly deserve it. And and I salute all the people who served in the military, and especially the women, because when I joined, women were not able to do combat duty were not able to do lots of things like fly jets. And that now we have women who are doing the same thing that the men do and could have done that all along, except for the fact that so many men, I hope I'm not in that group, so many men think women have to wait their turn or else do special things to earn the same kind of praise we get for just signing up. So that's my appreciation for being a veteran, and a thank you to all the people who give us credit.
Well, thank you, Stash, for your service and for your awareness and your story.
See, I am trainable.
So. Well, it's really interesting to me because my mom was a WAC, Women's Army Corps, and I haven't told pieces of her story very often, and I thought about it today, but I decided instead on another story because it's a better story. I've worked on it for, you know, told it a bunch of times, and it just is a better story. But I need to put some more energy into thinking about my mom's story because her service in the Army was definitely a really important part of her life, and the way that she came to enlist and the things she learned and how she changed over the years that she was with the service. It was really interesting.
I think that's great. I'm sure that some of her being a WAC had influence on you in ways you may not even have known.
I've thought about that. In fact, maybe that's the story I should tell.
Yeah. You know, it never dawned on me that women were treated so differently when I was a child, because my Aunt Martha, my dad's beautiful sister, was a WAC, mm-hmm. and had married a man from Georgia, my Uncle George, who had the most wonderful, deep Southern accent. And all during my childhood, you know, that Aunt Martha had been in the military in the Second World War and served abroad. And, you know, so when I started to learn that the women were treated so differently and had rules that prevented them from doing things, it was amazing to me that, you know, you're a member of my family, who was one of my favorites because she was so nice, and I love to go visit her and Uncle George, mostly to hear him talk. He was a great storyteller, and that voice was just mesmerizing to hear him speak. So that's great.
So. You've given me something to think about.
Oh, whoa. and not just something to
be outraged about.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's good. You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storing Hour at enlightenedradio.org, coming from Bolivar, West Virginia, with your hosts, Stacy Olkowski and
Fanny Crawford.
There you go.
You read my mind.
Well, you're wearing a red shirt, so I could tell. I know.
It's actually orange. But it doesn't show up orange on this.
Oh, that's close enough. It does.
The light, yeah.
Yeah, it depends on the lighting.
I almost never wear red, so when it looks red, it's disconcerting to me. I wear deep red, but not bright red. Okay.
All right.
Are we ready for another story?
Go. I'm waiting with bated breath, though I have no idea what that means.
Okay.
Sounds like you're trying to catch a fish by breathing or something. I don't know.
Okay. This is called Dreadnought. Jose Manuel Cabanillas was born 1901, a U.S. citizen in Mayagüez, Puerto Rico. Completed school at 16 years. Spent 2 years polishing his English at a small college on the U.S. mainland. And was the first Puerto Rican to graduate from the Naval Academy in Annapolis. In 1924, he was commissioned an ensign and thereafter served on Navy cruisers and destroyers and submarines. Early in his career, just off a cruiser docked in a California harbor, he met a young woman named Doris Minter, 16 years old, who'd been sent to live with her older married sister in California because her parents, back on their Enrico County, Virginia farm, were anxious about her keeping company with several over-attentive men, young men. In California, Doris alarmed her sister's husband, volunteering at local tea dances, which were chaperoned opportunities for young ladies to mingle with officers from visiting U.S. Navy vessels. The worried and very Presbyterian brother-in-law sent for Doris's parents to help him separate their vivacious daughter from the Roman Catholic ensign, Jose Cabanillas. Doris's parents arrived from Virginia within the week, courtesy of a family friend who worked on the Transcontinental Railroad. To the great surprise of all the elders in this tale, Doris's mother was instantly won over to the young people's point of view, impressed with the ensign's exquisite manners, charming and slightly accented English, his virtuoso violin playing, and his education. The mother won over the father, who calmed the brother-in-law, and both parents returned to Virginia, giving tacit approval to the union, but stipulating a long engagement and the development and sharing of a financial plan to support the new family. A week later, Doris and Jose eloped. Jose transferred to an East Coast port of call, and they began their married life with a visit to Puerto Rico to announce their marriage. Again, they somehow won over the Cabanillas clan, who had supposed their only son betrothed to a family friend and were disconcerted, to say the least, at the beginning. Well, by 1932, Jose had completed submarine training in New Haven, Connecticut, and a master's degree at Yale, courtesy of the Navy. Doris was ensconced with their children at the Minter Farm in Virginia while Jose was on active duty, and they were on excellent terms with their newly extended families, both the Cabanillases and the Minters. In 1942, Jose Cabanillas was assigned executive officer, second in command, and navigator on the USS Texas, carrying 1,000 men and the oldest remaining dreadnought, one of two ships in continuous service through World War I and World War II. Dreadnoughts were the predominant battleships of the early 20th century, named for the British Navy dreadnought, first of its kind in 1906. It had two revolutionary features: more heavy caliber guns than earlier battleships and two steam turbine propellers, making them, at least in 1906, fast and nearly invincible. On board the Texas, Captain Cabanillas participated in two of the most important operations of World War II. The first was the 1942 invasion of North Africa. The Texas escorted war convoys across the Atlantic and then provided shore bombardment from her big 14-inch guns, shelling the Axis-held beaches. At one point, the crew had the specific responsibility of bombarding and destroying an ammunition depot near Port Leyte, controlled by the Vichy French in Morocco. And on the morning of November 8, 1942, Lieutenant General Dwight D. Eisenhower arrived on the Texas to transmit the very first Voice of Freedom radio transmission. The firefight began shortly after that broadcast, succeeded by attacks over the next 2 days, with a ceasefire finally declared on November 11th. And the Texas left North Africa November 16th for the east coast of the US. But from their departure out of Norfolk to Port Leyte and then back again, the second most famous person on board after Eisenhower was a then junior journalist named Walter Cronkite. And that newsman made friends with the crew and officers, and on the return trip, when they were within flying range of Norfolk, he received permission to be flown from the battleship back to the mainland. And a Kingfisher plane was launched with Cronkite in the passenger seat to race a competing journalist aboard the USS Massachusetts and be the first to publish an uncensored report of Operation Torch, the North African campaign. And that submission was the spark that ignited Cronkite's career as a war correspondent. So Papa Joe, which is what we call Jose Cabanillas, counted Cronkite as an acquaintance. The Texas continued as a convoy escort for many Atlantic crossings, but her second major engagement began when General Eisenhower boarded again to address the crew, naming her the Bombardment Force flagship for Omaha Beach Western Task Force. In early June 1944, the Texas took up a firing position at Omaha Beach, 12,000 yards from Pointe de Hoc, the high ground filled with German guns overlooking the beach. The US and British flotilla numbered more than 700 ships with 7 battleships and 5 heavy cruisers. The Texas led firefights at Omaha Beach throughout the month of June and provided critical supplies and rescue assistance to infantry troops. On June 25th, during continuous bombardment of the German guns on Pointe de Hoc, German shells sheared the top off the Texas bridge and incapacitated 11 men on board. The ship's commander, Captain Baker, was directing the firefight from the bridge. He was not injured, but the blast effectively cut him off from the rest of the ship, and the commander was incommunicado. The bridge was out of the fight. But the Texas continued the bombardment under command of the executive officer, Captain Jose Cabanillas, from the ship's navigation tower. And the Texas was near missed or hit directly 65 times that day in June, but her guns never stopped till Captain Cabanillas had accomplished the destruction of those German guns, and his medals and commendations confirm that accomplishment. Captain Jose Cabanillas was my husband's grandfather, the man we call Papa Joe. We have a letter he wrote in 1942 during the invasion of North Africa, addressed to Preciosa Mia, my darling girl, Doris Minter Cabanillas. And that letter is something of a family treasure, but I was sworn to secrecy to not actually quote from the letter. Papa Joe's daughter, my husband's mother, thinks it would be too embarrassing to him to hear that information broadcast to the world. Commended for his combat service with the rank of Rear Admiral on his retirement from the Navy, the first Puerto Rican to attain that rank, Jose Cabanillas went to law school on the GI Bill at age 54, passed the bar on his first exam, and practiced law in Virginia till his death in 1979. Grandma Doris Preciosa of the letter survived her husband by 20-some years, departing this world just short of her 102nd birthday. A force of nature till the very end. Dreadnought in archaic English means fear nothing.
Yeah, I had muted myself so I could listen and not disturb you. Because when we first started doing these broadcasts through this stuff, I had a bad habit of drumming and singing and whistling and so, you know. So anyway, boy, what a wonderful story.
You exaggerate.
Yeah. Always. But that's a wonderful story. Wow.
I love it.
And that's your great grandfather?
No, that's my husband's grandfather.
Your husband's grandfather. Okay.
Yes.
Right. Okay. I get confused sometimes. I put people together because they're married, they have the same relatives.
Well, we do. That's true.
I know. but that's wonderful. What a wonderful thing.
Oh. He was wonderful. He's a wonderful man. And his wife, also, something of a tornado.
Yeah. I imagine he had to be better than most.
You would think, in
the United States, in the Navy. Whoa. Yeah. You know, because...
His men loved him. There was a reunion of the Texas a few years ago. The ship is in Texas. I can't remember which harbor it's in now off the top of my head. But my mother-in-law went with other family members, with her sister-in-law to represent her brother. And... a couple of the kids went with her, and it was a really big deal. And there were a lot of people there who remembered Captain Cabanillas, Rear Admiral.
Wow.
Cabanillas, and spoke really fondly of him. They got to see his quarters and the places where he worked on the ship.
Wow.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
That's really neat. And so is the Texas in dry dock or?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, boy, that is really something. That's quite impressive.
Impressed. Yeah.
Even if it wasn't your relative, that's an impressive service record. And, especially that when you mentioned the reunions, it reminded me I lived in Frederick, Maryland, a number of years, and every place I lived, I've always had a hard time finding a good barber to take care of my beard, because I'm not skilled enough to do my beard properly, so I have to have somebody, and I did find an older gentleman who had a small shop in Frederick, and right from the first time I accidentally saw the barbershop, unobtrusive, in a row house, and I began going there, and he was just a wonderful, wonderful person, a veteran of World War II, and listening to your story reminded me of him, because he every year I went to him for probably 10 years and, a few, every couple months. And every year he would be so excited, and he would say, he would remind his customers, not only me, I won't be here the week of so-and-so because I'm going to see my shipmates. And that yearly reunion, and each year he would tell, this guy was a great old barber. He could have trimmed my beard and a little bit of hair. And well, then I did have hair then, and in probably 20 minutes, but he normally took about an hour.
Wow.
It was an old fashioned barbershop. And he would tell people, I'm slow, so if you don't mind waiting, you know, I'll get to you. But he had a great many men who valued his service, and I did, because I loved listening to his stories. And each year, it started to dawn on me that it was a great occasion for him to go to his reunion, but it was becoming more and more difficult because there were fewer and fewer of his comrades. And the last year that he went that I know of, there were only three men, himself and three others, who and this was in 19, well, actually in the early 2000s, so 50 some years after the war. And he was very sad, and he said, I don't think I may not even go next year, because I hate the thought of it. And he wasn't married, or his wife had passed away, so he was a bachelor. And shortly after that, he passed away. And I thought, well, at least he had made the last reunion while he was alive. And I felt sort of consoled by the fact that he wouldn't go back anymore and possibly be the last one. So, and that's my barber story. he was such a great guy, and he was very old. He was very old fashioned, and he kept, I think this is okay to say, because nobody knows his name and it's not a bad thing, but you know, barbershops always had magazines. And when I was a kid, the barbershop I went to as a kid, they had a magazine. I want to say it was called the Police Gazette, but maybe that's the wrong name. But anyway, it had something to do with the police and criminals. And it was kind of neat to pick up those and read it as a young kid, you know, 12, 13 years old. And but the barber in Frederick, this is years later, I wasn't a kid anymore, but he had one special magazine that he kept on the bottom of the pile up near the mirror. And a couple of times while I was in the chair, and one of his older people came in, and I can remember the question became so funny to me. Where's the new magazine? And he would point to the pile, and he would say to me, I'm in the chair, excuse me, I'll be right back with you. And he'd go over and lift that pile and pull that bottom magazine out. And it was a Playboy. And it was the early 2000s. I thought, why is it? Oh, well, because of their age, because of his age and the customer's age, it was like the, you know, Playboy magazine was pretty scandalous when it first came out. And, it didn't scandalize me, but I thought to myself, I guess if I ever have to wait and he offers the chance for me to look at the magazine, I will have made it. And but I never did. I usually went to him at a time when I knew I'd probably not have to wait very long. I tried to get him when he was first opening, and he opened at 10 o'clock in the morning. There were some barbershops open much earlier, but he said once to me, you know, I don't have to do this. I worked hard and saved my money, and I just do this because I want somebody to talk to. And he lived alone and everything. So anyway, I can remember just having to really control my laughter about that Playboy magazine. And a lady, actually, after he died, a lady took over his shop. And she was very good. I went to her. She was the first person that shaved my head. I was just before, not long before leaving Frederick. And I had taken a short part in a play. And the character was pretty bizarre. And I thought, my hair was getting kind of thin anyway. And I thought, you know what? I think that character would be bald. And I told the director, and he said, oh, I think that'd be great. But, you know, and it just so happened at the time, it was when I had just gotten my second tattoo, which no one had ever seen except for my wife and my children. And so in the show, I was not only bald, I also had one of those tank tops, you know, with the thin spaghetti straps. And a bathing suit, because I was a defrocked priest and roaming the beaches. And when I showed up for the first rehearsal with the tattoos and the bald head, people were aghast because they didn't know I had tattoos, and they were very modest tattoos, you know, a harp on one shoulder and a accordion on the other. But anyway, that lady was really nice, because when I went to the barbershop and I told her I needed my head shaved, and I couldn't find anybody in town who would shave my head. So, which was amazing. I thought, you know, they said they would trim it close, but they didn't do shaved heads. So, but she did. So, boy, that was a ramble.
Is that shop still open?
I don't think so. The last time I was in Frederick and on that street, which was, what would you call that street? I don't know. I think maybe 7th Street. It ran north and south. And I didn't see the sign. There was, you know, the barber neon sign was gone, and the pole, you know, the candy stick pole, candy cane pole.
I think 7th Street runs east and west.
Does it? Yeah, let's see.
Because yeah, Market Street runs north and south. Market.
North and south. Well, this street runs north and south, and I'm not sure which one it was. It might have been Market Street, because it was up north. Mm-hmm. You know, I think
could have been at 7th Street.
You know what? That's why it's 7th Street, because it was in that block.
Yeah.
So
great.
Let's see. Oh boy. Yeah. And he was a wonderful veteran. He told some wonderful stories, you know. And his stories were, he told funny stories about himself and his buddies. I asked him once, you know, you were on a ship in a war. You must have seen a lot of action. He said, you know, I don't ever tell people about anything I saw. He said, that wasn't fun. It wasn't interesting. And I don't like to hear guys talk about it, because some of them exaggerate what happened. And he said, stories about men being killed and about bravery and all that stuff, but they belong in a different place, not in the barbershop. And I really admired that, because, you know, his stories were about making mistakes, doing things, you know, somebody getting in trouble and messing up and things. So if you didn't know he had been in this military, in a war, you would have thought that he was like Gomer Pyle or somebody, you know. So, but he wasn't. And he also did share with me a nice memory book that he had, which were pictures of his friends and a couple of certificates of commendation for him. And but he just said, I don't want to. I'd ask him about, you know, do you have any mementos? I was curious. That, you know, I was doing storytelling then and theater, and I thought it would be an interesting story. But getting to know him pretty well, I knew he wouldn't want me telling anything about that memory book. So I have never talked about it. But it was nice to see that, you know, the unfunny side, kind of the serious mm-hmm. side of his military service.
Photographs make a big difference in those kinds of stories.
Oh my goodness.
Because it's really hard to, whatever's in your head, you know, it's helped, aided by seeing actual.
Sure. Well, when you see somebody in a military uniform from 60 years ago, I can imagine that you would have a hard time looking at me in a uniform from 1960.
I've never 61. Seen any of your service photos.
No.
In a single one.
Nope. I doubt if I've ever put one any place. You know.
Next time I come to your house in 2017, you're gonna
in 2017.
In my
if you come to my house in 2017, I probably won't be there.
Sure you will. It could take that long. Anyway.
Wow.
Do you have a 2-minute story?
I do.
This down?
I do. This is a personal story.
Okay.
A number of years ago, a man by the name of Joseph Fahrenholt, I'm so impressed that I remember this, who ran a auto repair shop and bought old cars and fixed them up and everything. I had a Volkswagen van that didn't have any heat and I had, you know, run it into the ground. I loved it, but it sat in my yard for about 8 months because I didn't know what to do with it, you know. And I heard about this guy from a friend, and I called the number, and he said, I'll send somebody over to take a look at it and see if I think it's worth it. And then he called me back, and he said, my guy looked at it, and he said, this is back in the, I guess, in the mid-70s. And he said, I'll give you $200, and I'll come and pick it up, you know, because it wasn't running. I said, oh, that sounds fair. And he said, so I'll send somebody over with a truck, and they'll tow it out of your yard. And he said, the day they do that, then if you come over, follow them over to my shop. So I did. And I went to a shop, and it was on Route 30 outside of Reisterstown. And I walked into the shop, and he said, I'm kind of busy, so, you know, tell me what name I should write on a check and everything, because I had a check written. And I said my name, and he stopped. He said, okay, did you go out in Baltimore? And I said, yes, I did. And he said, did you have an uncle by the name of Lou? I said, yeah, actually, his name was Ludwig. And he said, yeah. He said, I've never seen that name since World War II. He said, your uncle Lou and I and another guy, before shipping out, and during the Second World War, before shipping out to overseas, the three of us went to Baltimore where he was from, and we attended a family wedding. And he said, it was one of the best times of my life. And he said, I guess you know he died. And I said, yeah, I know he was killed in the war. And he said, the three of us were together. And when he got killed, and he said, I probably, over the years, I probably thought a number of times that I should go and look for his family, but I just couldn't do it. And so I said, do you mind if I tell my family? I said, because my uncles, and I said, my father has passed away, but my uncles, his other brothers are still alive. And he said, no, please. So I took down his name, and I always remember it was Joe Fahrenholt, because he had a son or grandson who was a runner, an excellent track man, and I had seen the kid run. And that name stuck in my mind because, you know, the better people in sports always stick out. And so I was able to take down that information and tell my uncle Joel and my uncle Frank and Frankie. And so they were able to communicate with him and able to learn some things about their brother from a friend, you know. And it turned out that they were at one of my aunts got married at that time. And my uncles weren't home at the time because they were both in the war, the other ones. So anyway, it was such a thing, you know, serendipity was one of those things that really made me realize how people are connected in different ways. And I don't think I ever saw the man again, but I've never forgotten him or his name.
Wow, that's a wonderful story. Baltimore!
How about that?
All right. I think it's time to end this carnival.
I'm always tempted to say what Click and Clack would say at the end of their show. Did you ever listen to the Click and Clack
show? Yeah, all the time. Still do.
It was just wonderful. Said, well, you've wasted another hour of your life.
That's right. Well, wait, and we are over time. So
it's okay.
This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stassi Olkowski.
Your co-hosts for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, independent community radio and ship in Bolivar, West Virginia, closing out this week's show. The Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. What's up next, John?
Well, mainly I'm probably going to be playing jazz most of the day because I'm working on other projects. So.
Jazz.
Yeah. Jazz. I like mostly older jazz, but